Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Welcome, and thank you for tuning into this week's episode of Maryland's Most Notorious Murders, where the most gruesome, the most horrific, the most high-profile homicides occurring in Maryland, they are discussed, they are examined, and they are profiled. Now, before I go any further, I have to add a legal disclaimer to each of these episodes. So, 95% of the material obtained for these cases is material obtained from online public record, or any type of online public source or online public articles that have been obtained directly from the news media online, including mainly the Baltimore Sun, the Daily Record, Fox 45 News, CBS News, and WBAL News. In some cases, the actual participants were contacted for their input or for their version of the story. And in some cases, the participants responded and their input was included in their case profile or case episode. If the participants did not respond to requests for interviews, then the information obtained for the episode was obtained from online public record. So without further ado, let's get into it. For this season, season 10, in my opinion, I've said this before, being a police officer, a correctional officer, or any career in law enforcement really is one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. So for this season, season 10, the focus is on any high-profile law enforcement-related type of homicides. And this can include murders that were committed on any law enforcement official or any murders that were committed by any law enforcement official. And when I say law enforcement officials, for this season, I am referring strictly to police officers, I'm referring to state troopers, and I am referring to correctional officers. And this episode's case of law enforcement homicide occurring in Maryland that I'm going to profile is the double murder of Baltimore City police officers Adam Vasquez and Leslie Ann Holliday. And because this is a podcast that focuses on the most high-profile homicides occurring in Maryland, to be fair, this podcast also has a huge goal in assisting with any unsolved homicide that needs a second look or special attention because the case is now considered a cold case. And this episode's unsolved homicide is the 35-year-old murder of 37-year-old Gladys Faye Dobbins Beauchamp. Ooh, man, I'm telling y'all, the pain from rejection, that can be a motherfucker. I mean, it don't matter if you're a man or a woman, it goes both ways. Some people just cannot take it when somebody just don't want them no more. They simply can't take that shit when you simply just don't want to be with a person no more. Like, no, I don't want you. And to be honest, like, you know, I may have never wanted you in the first place. Like, some people just can't take that. They put their heart and everything all into relationships. And when it doesn't go the way they want or when the other person doesn't reciprocate it, then it's just not good. I mean, some people just can't learn to let go. And when they break up, things are not good. It's not, you know, good. Like Usher may want them to be, but some people, breakups can be disastrous and they can be deadly because people really put their feelings out there. People be thinking that police officers, you would think that they would know better. You would think that because they receive all types of extensive background checks, they receive all type of, supposedly receive all type of, you know, mental evaluations periodically and stuff like that, that obviously police officers should know how to act when somebody don't want to be with them no more. A police officer should already have the mental capacity to be able to handle something as simple as a damn breakup. But that wasn't the case for General Services Police Officer Eugene Victor Perry Jr. Now, ever since he was a kid, Eugene wanted to have a career in law enforcement. And after high school, Eugene began his career in law enforcement as a 23-year-old correctional officer at Baltimore's Central Book and Intake Facility. Eugene worked there for 8 years processing new inmates coming into the detention center. And he processed, you know, inmates, you know, coming back and forth. Either way, while working at Central Book, and Eugene met his co-worker, Leslie Ann Holiday. Leslie, who was raised in Harford County, she graduated from Joppatown High School and had worked as a paralegal at two law firms, and she worked as a volunteer at Falston General Hospital. Leslie was raising a daughter and two sons after she had got a divorce from her kid's father. Leslie had been divorced for about 5 years and was working as a correctional officer at Central Booking when she and Eugene started a relationship. The couple worked together and they dated, and eventually, like a lot of people do, they got engaged. But in the fall of 2005, after being engaged for about 2 years, the couple broke up. Leslie left Central Booking and she applied to the Baltimore City Police Department. Leslie was hired as a police officer, and she was assigned to the midnight shift in the Northwestern District of Baltimore City after she had completed 3 months of field training. Eugene tried to get hired as a police officer too, and he briefly worked as an officer for the Housing Authority of Baltimore City. But when that whole Housing Authority police like Project Cop thing, when that disbanded, any of these like officers who had worked policing projects, if they wanted to, they could transfer over to becoming police officers for the city of Baltimore. But before they could fully become police officers, everybody who still applied, they had to undergo another extensive background check and evaluation. Eugene was one of those officers, and he applied to become one of these Baltimore City police officers, but for reasons that were not really made clear, Eugene was not hired as a Baltimore City police officer, but he obtained a position as a general service officer with the state of Maryland. Well, basically with the State Department of General Services. A general service officer, it's a police officer. They sworn in like regular police officers. They can carry a gun like a regular cop, and they can arrest you like a regular cop. There are only about 90 general service officers in Maryland, and these officers, their main function is to provide security at most state office buildings in Annapolis, or the state office buildings in Baltimore, or like, you know, that state office building in Reisterstown. Not all of these general service officers carry guns, though. About 80 of these general service officers, they not armed, and they can't arrest you, and they have, you know, no arrest powers or anything like that. They just mainly like high powered security officers. But Eugene was one of the officers that was armed, and he carried a 40 Glock caliber service weapon. After Leslie broke up with Eugene and she gave him back his engagement ring and everything and moved on, they both had moved on to work at different jobs. Leslie had moved on again, and she started dating somebody else. 26-year-old Adam Vasquez was born and raised on 53rd Street in Sunset Park in Brooklyn, New York. Adam was the youngest of three siblings in a big, close Puerto Rican family. Growing up, Adam was a good kid. He stayed out of trouble, never caused any problems, you know, with his parents and everything, and he developed an interest in law enforcement from an early age. After graduating from high school, Adam went on to Kingsboro Community College, where he was recruited by Baltimore City police officers to join their police force. Instead, Adam spent some time fighting for our country first, and then he joined the Army Reserve. After spending some time in the military, Adam decided to take up the Baltimore police officers' offers, and he decided to become a police officer in Baltimore City instead of becoming a police officer in his hometown of Brooklyn, because basically, if you becoming a Baltimore City police officer, that came with a huge incentive for young Adam. If you became an officer in the city of Bemore, you automatically became eligible for their homeowner program that the city offers for any cops that's brave enough to police this dangerous ass city. They're throwing a homeownership in there. So, lured by the prospects of owning his own, new homeownership, Adam moved from Brooklyn to Maryland and became a cop in Bemore and brought a new townhome in the 3900 block of My Lady's Court in the Cortland Manor neighborhood of Pikesville. Assigned to the Northwest District, Adam worked the night shift as a police officer for 4 years before he started dating Leslie, who was also assigned to the night shift. Now, when Leslie and Adam started dating, Eugene ain't like this shit not one bit. Even though they was broke up, and he was like a woman scorned. And Eugene started doing bitch shit, like stalking Leslie, calling and hanging up. Eugene found out where Adam lived, and he told a friend that he went to Adam's house to quote-unquote see them. And according to articles in the Baltimore Sun, Eugene told friends that he could just kill them both. Then, on December the 21st, 2005, Eugene's jealousy and bitchiness got the best of him. With absolutely no thoughts to his flawless criminal record and law enforcement career, early in the morning, 33-year-old Eugene went to Adam's townhome in Pikesville, where he saw Leslie's car parked out front. Then he slashed her tires on her car like a bitch and left a note on her windshield talking about some "knew you would do it again." Then he drove to a police gun firing range where he tested how good of a shot he was. Then, at around noon, Eugene just couldn't leave it alone. Thoughts just kept flashing in his head, and he just could not get over the fact that Leslie simply did not want him no more. And he left him. She couldn't get over the fact that she had left him to be with a more stable, more mature, much younger man, which they probably would have been broken up months before this even. He had nothing to do with it. I just don't want to be with you. Eugene just could not swallow that shit. So at around noon, Eugene headed back over to Adam's house. This time, Eugene got out his car and knocked on Adam's front door, knowing that Leslie was inside. Adam's cousin, his cousin's wife, and their young child had been visiting Adam from New York, and they had been staying at Adam's house when Eugene rang Adam's doorbell. Adam's cousin's wife came to the door, and Eugene was like, "Is Leslie here?" But before the woman could really answer, Eugene pushed his way in through the front door and went upstairs to the bedroom where he found Leslie and Adam lying in Adam's bed. And that's when the shots rang out. Eugene pulled out his service handgun, caught Leslie and her new young boyfriend off guard, and shot both of them while they lay in Adam's bed. Shooting Adam 3 times and Leslie 5 times, Eugene ended both of these police officers' lives right then and right there. After shooting them both, Eugene ran out of the house while Adam's cousin called 911. Baltimore County police officers showed up to the home around 12:10 p.m., and both Leslie and Adam were pronounced dead shortly after. Eugene went to his brother's job after killing the officers, and Eugene's brother convinced him to turn himself into Baltimore County Police Woodlawn's precinct, which Adam did at around 2 p.m. I mean, which Eugene did at around 2 p.m. And Eugene was immediately arrested and charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder and held on a no-bail status. Leslie's mother had been home watching TV when she saw a news crawler at the bottom of the screen saying that 2 police officers had been killed in Pikesville, and she saw a picture of the crime scene that shows Leslie's car on the screen, and she said to herself, "That's Leslie's car." Leslie's mother called her daughter immediately and left Leslie a voicemail message saying, "Leslie, call me." But of course, Leslie couldn't call her. And that's how she found out that her daughter had been killed, by watching the news. Adam had been a 4.5-year veteran of the police force, and he had lived at his new home for only 9 months before his life was taken from him by a jealous ex-boyfriend who ain't know how to move the fuck on. Adam's neighbors all said that Adam was the type of neighbor that kept to himself, and that they would see him in the neighborhood sometimes walking his dog named Peanut. One neighbor commented to the press saying that, in her words, Adam was an outstanding officer since day one when he walked into the academy. Leslie was still new to the police force, having been there for only about 1.5 years. She was still on a probationary period, but getting close to the end of her probationary period before her life was taken, before she even had a chance to even experience life as a police officer. And the Leslie's supervisor commented to the press saying, "She was very vibrant, very enthusiastic and conscientious. She loved her job and she loved her family. She was always motivated to succeed and developing into the kind of police officer that we wanted." At the Northwestern District, an American flag was lowered to half-staff, buried at Greenwood Cemetery in New York in his police officer's uniform in a mass funeral where many of Adam's co-workers attended. Adam's funeral was in his hometown of Brooklyn, New York, at Basilica of Our Lady of Perpetual Help on Fifth Avenue in Sunset Park, just a few blocks from where Adam grew up. According to an article in the New York Times, Adam was like a local hero in New York, and his funeral was so sad that Adam's 5-year-old cousin screamed out, "I don't want him to go. I didn't want him to die. I'm gonna miss you, Adam." And the child tried to throw herself on his grave, which had the whole funeral home in tears, including the many police officers from Bemore who went to Adam's funeral. A Baltimore police officer who went to Adam's funeral commented to the New York Times saying, in his words, "He protected the people of Baltimore, but Brooklyn never stopped being his home. He had his roots in New York, but he was trying to show his family what it must be like to live in Maryland." And a family member of Adams commented to the press in his words saying, "Here's a pure Brooklyn kid who forced himself to leave for a better life for himself and his family. He was reaching back home to pull them with him. He wanted to show them you can buy a house and live decent elsewhere." Meanwhile, at jail, all of a sudden, Eugene was suddenly mentally ill. And according to his lawyer, he couldn't really get nowhere with Eugene because every time he tried to ask Eugene anything about the murders, Eugene starts spazzing out, losing it. Like, he can't talk. He can't breathe. Like, he can't take hearing about what he did. Like, yeah, whatever. I mean, don't bitch up now, dude. Eugene's lawyer commented to the Baltimore Sun that Eugene was now, all of a sudden, hearing voices, and that Eugene gets particularly emotional whenever somebody tries to talk to him about the murders. I mean, should I get emotional too? But that don't mean I'm mentally ill. Anyway, Eugene's lawyer said, in his words, he said, "If you force it to him, it's like approaching Dracula with the cross. He breaks down. He almost makes his way into a fetal position." Get the fuck out of here. I mean, get the fuck out of here, y'all. So, how you supposed to act? I mean, now you want to act crazy. Were you crazy when you was applying to become a police officer? Because all of a sudden, Eugene... Because all of a sudden, Eugene wanted to win an Academy Award for his acting. A judge signed an order stating that Eugene wasn't able to understand the nature or object of the proceeding or to assist in his defense. And on July 13th, 2006, Eugene's trial was put on hold because now Eugene was suddenly incompetent to stand trial by Maryland state doctors, who determined that Eugene suffered from a mental disorder that makes him dangerous. So Eugene was held at Clifton T. Perkins Psychiatric Hospital Center for treatment while he was sane enough to begin his trial, or whenever he was found to no longer be a danger to himself or others. An official from the state health department wrote to the judge that he believed Eugene may have lacked substantial capacity to appreciate the criminality of his conduct and to conform that conduct to the requirements of the law. Prosecutors wasn't giving up, though, and every 6 months, Eugene was evaluated by doctors to see if he was fit for trial and if he understood what was going on with his case. Eugene managed to play dumb for 3 years, perhaps because he wanted to stay at Clifton T. Perkins, but eventually the jig was up, and after about a year spent at Clifton, Eugene was found fit to stand trial, and Eugene faced the death penalty for murdering both of the officers in cold blood. Eugene was offered a deal of a life sentence without the possibility for parole for, you know, the double murder to avoid the death penalty. But for some reason, Eugene felt that he ain't deserved the death penalty and that the sentence was too harsh for him. It was too harsh for him to accept. So Eugene rejected that plea deal, and he stalled some more. Then Eugene was offered a sentence of 2 consecutive life sentences, but Eugene thought that that sentence was too much for him to bear too, because that would mean that he would never have any hope for any release, and he would die in prison without the possibility for parole. Finally, on March the 27th, 2008, after stalling for almost 3 years, Eugene accepted a sentence of 2 concurrent life terms in prison. Now, this sentence came with the possibility for parole, but to be released from prison or paroled from prison for this particular murder, you would have to be pardoned by the governor himself, which is literally your only chance or hope for any type of release. I don't see that happening. In other words, Eugene ain't never getting out of prison for killing 2 cops in cold blood, no matter what the reason was or what state of mind he was in. After Eugene was sentenced, his lawyer gave a statement to the press saying, in his words, "It wasn't going to get any better than that. There wasn't any hope of winning, of getting an acquittal. There was too much evidence, just too much evidence on the case. It was too horrendous of a crime. 2 police officers killed in their bed." But he went from facing the death penalty to having some light at the end of the tunnel. Sheesh. At Eugene's sentencing hearing, Eugene did apologize to Leslie's parents, showing some form of remorse. I chose this case as one of Maryland's most notorious law enforcement homicide cases because his lying fake ass. I mean, was he mentally ill when he pulled that trigger? Was he mentally ill when he took these evaluations to become a police officer? Or what? How is that mentally ill? You walked up to them steps, you knocked on that on his door, and you did what you did because you were pissed off that she didn't want to be with you no more. That is not mentally ill. That was planned, it was calculated, and it was cold, and he should never, ever be released for that. And to make it even worse, you had the nerve to try to be a police officer? You was trying to be a cop? I mean, so what? She moved on. She gave you the ring back. Most bitches wouldn't have done that. So what? She moved on. Learn to let go. Stop being in your feelings all the time. Most cops be thinking they the shit all the time, and guess what? You weren't. Ain't no way you're going to kill 2 cops. Ain't no way in the world you was going to kill 2 cops and fake that you mentally ill, especially when you a goddamn cop yourself. Really? I mean, I bitch up and I do all this shit too if I came to the realization that I'm fucked because I couldn't control my emotions. I feel sorry. When I heard about this one, I felt so sorry for the kids. She seemed like she was, you know, taking care of 3 kids. That's not easy to be, you know, like how young she was. And to especially to be a police officer and to know that their mother, you know, was an officer. I know that that had to be something hard to deal with as kids. And then to be killed, not by like in the line of duty or anything like that, but to be killed by a disgruntled lover who don't know how to move the fuck on. You know, if I had a chance to interview Eugene, I would ask him, if you could go back and do things differently, would you? Or was it worth it? And the dude, her boyfriend, he in the wrong place at the wrong time, had nothing to do with anything. You know, when I heard about this case, I was just like, wow, man. Wow. And to his shenanigans of playing mentally ill and stalling. Wow. I was just appalled by the whole thing. I just could not believe that he really took it this far. And no, he will never see the light of day. I'll never see him getting out. The governor is never going to pardon him for shooting 2 cops because he was mentally ill or because he couldn't take being rejected. So no, I did select this case as one of Maryland's most notorious law enforcement homicides occurring in the state of Maryland, of course. Now, moving right on into this episode's unsolved homicide. But before I do, let me say this, that this is a podcast that does focus on high-profile homicides occurring in the state of Maryland, that I do know. And I do realize that a lot of attention and focus is placed on homicides that may have received a lot of attention, may have received a lot of press, and a lot of notoriety. On the flip side, this podcast also has a huge goal, a major goal, in assisting with lesser known homicides occurring in this state that did not receive the level of press or media coverage that they deserved. It's like one minute the victim was here, and the next minute they were not. And it's a shame that the families, it's just a shame that the friends and the families of the victims, they're left to just pick up where they left off and expected to just move on with their life like nothing ever happened, and to just go on living with huge gaping holes in their heart that can't be filled. This portion of this podcast shines a light on these forgotten homicides, giving a voice to the voiceless and what is now silent, and offers some type of hope for justice. And this episode's unsolved homicide is the murder of 37-year-old Gladys Faye Dobbins Beauchamp. Glen Burnie, Maryland is a suburban county in Anne Arundel County. Glen Burnie has seen its fair share of crime and homicides throughout the years, but during the fall of 1989, Glen Burnie became the scene of a brutal and horrific homicide. 37-year-old Gladys Faye Dobbins Beauchamp, who lived on East Patapsco Avenue in Brooklyn, was a mother of 2 children who worked as a housekeeper at the North Arundel Convalescent Center, and every day her routine was like clockwork. On work days, Gladys usually caught the number 14 MTA bus at 5:45 a.m. at the corner of Patapsco and Hanover Street, riding the bus until she reached the intersection of Crane Highway and Aquahart Road. After Gladys got off the bus at around 6:10 a.m., Gladys would walk to the Hardee's to get something to eat before heading on to her job on Hospital Drive at the Southgate Shopping Center. The police believe that Gladys was following this exact routine on the morning of October 11, 1989, when Gladys didn't show up for work that morning. That same day, around 3:30 p.m., a kid was riding his bike near a wooded area near Crane Highway and Oak Manor Drive, about 20 feet off of a bicycle trail in Glen Burnie, when he found Gladys' body lying face down in a pile of leaves. The police were called, and it was later determined that Gladys had been sexually assaulted. There was evidence that Gladys fought viciously for her life because she had numerous defensive wounds and her clothes were torn. In fact, Gladys' manner of death was so unique to the investigators that they never released to the press how she was killed, saying that the way Gladys was killed would only be known to her killer. A police spokesperson commented to the press that Gladys' manner of death, obviously, is something pretty unique. At first, detectives thought that maybe Gladys' murder was connected to three other sexual assaults that had been reported in the area by three other women, but there was no real proof or connection or links to this theory. Gladys was engaged and was planning to get married the following month, but unfortunately, she was brutally murdered first. And the police need your help in this case. So if you have any information that you want to provide in this 35-year-old unsolved homicide, please call the Anne Arundel County Police Department at 410-222-3456 or Metro Crime Stoppers at 1-866-7-LOCKUP. That's 1-866-756-2587 on your numeric keypad. You can also text MCS plus the tip to 274-637 or visit tipsubmit.com. You can also call the Anne Arundel County Cold Case Department at 410-222-4731. I'm going to repeat those numbers again because I know there were a lot of numbers. You can call the Anne Arundel County Police Department if you have any information for this homicide at 410-222-3456. Or you can call Metro Crime Stoppers at 1-866-7-LOCKUP. Or on your numeric keypad, those numbers are 1-866-756-2587. You can also text MCS plus the tip that you want to provide to 274-637. Or you can visit tipsubmit.com where you can submit your tip online. You can also call the Anne Arundel County Cold Case Department at 410-222-4731. There is a reward of up to $10,000 for any information leading to an arrest or conviction for this unsolved homicide, and you can remain anonymous. Thank you for tuning in this week. Before I go into my usual routine of how you can access prior episodes, let me mention that if you tune into me at all, the last couple seasons, I did tell my listeners that I was producing a true crime documentary that was based off of my very first episode, and that episode that profiled accused child killers Adon Canella and Policarpio Espinoza. And yes, the documentary is now currently available. But because of the extreme graphic nature of the documentary involving the brutal and horrific beheading murders of three innocent children, networks kind of shied away from me, basically told me that the documentary was too graphic, too much for network TV, and, you know, even too harsh for YouTube, which is surprising to me. I guess because the documentary does include images of the actual crime scene photos and stuff like that, I refused to pull these images there. I blurred them a little bit the best I could, but I refused to pull these photos for the documentary because I believe that in order to fully emphasize the fact that Adon and Policarpio did not commit this horrible homicide, I had to show what was done to these kids with no sugarcoating, no cut cards, no bullshit. So there's no way that the victim's uncle and cousins committed these murders that were some of the most brutal that B-More has seen. Adon is about to be released anyway, after serving, being locked up since 2002. Either way, the documentary is available via email only, via a WeTransfer link. That's how you're going to get the documentary. I'm going to send it to you in a link, in a WeTransfer link. I do admit that the documentary is not for everybody's eyes, and this documentary was not produced to make money, to get likes or subscribers or anything like that, which is another reason why I didn't choose the typical network route. I cannot and I will not be censored, especially when it comes to true crime, and especially when it comes to facts about an injustice that is currently going on. So, in order to see the documentary, please visit my website at MaryLandsMostNotoriousMurders.com, and Maryland is spelled MDS. You can subscribe to the mailing list by leaving your email, and specifically send me a request that you want to see the documentary, and I will email the video to you within 24 hours. I have to warn you, though, the video is very graphic. Very gruesome. As I said before, networks told me no because of its violent and extreme graphic content regarding children. But I believe, to be honest, in my opinion, I truly believe that with the state of the world and the way that it is now, I just feel like nobody cares that these two illegal immigrants are locked up serving life sentences for crime that they didn't commit, because a lot of people feel like, look, they weren't supposed to be over here anyway. And nobody cares. You know, after speaking with the family extensively and stuff like that, I can't say that they don't care, but they're like, where they came from, you know, Mexico, shit, prison ain't is better. So that's why I produced the documentary, you know, to open up people's eyes and to let them know what's really going on. And while you're at it, please be sure to subscribe to this podcast via Spotify for updates on future spine-tingling, eye-popping, eye-hair-raising episodes. And for paid subscribers, be sure to check out the real, the raw, the uncensored version of why I decided to start a true crime podcast. A lot of people think that, you know, I just woke up one day and jumped on a bandwagon with everybody's podcast, and then, boom, here go a podcast. Nope, that is not even hardly true. I've been in this game for minutes. There is a real therapeutic message to this true crime world of gore and mayhem. And if you click on the episode entitled Why I Do What I Do, you'll understand more about why I'm so weird, so crazy, and so fascinated with true crime. And while you're at it, my website, MarylandsMostNotoriousMurders.com. Be sure to check out any prior episodes that you may have missed with all of the different seasons that we have featured and focused on, like suicide-related homicides, parasite murders, or sick, twisted pedophile or sex-related type of homicides occurring in Maryland, which is a weird episode, a weird season. You can also find links to all of my true crime books that are loosely related to this podcast, entitled Maryland's Most Notorious Murders, 1990 through 2008, Maryland's Unsolved Homicides, Volume 1, Until I Get Caught, The True Story of a Serial Rapist in Baltimore, which is a book that every woman should read. I mean, it is shocking. You can also check me out on Season 1 of Payback, which airs for the TV1 network. You can also check me out on the Oxygen Network for Black Widow Murders, where I profiled Maryland's female serial killer, Josephine Gray. Or you can check me out on TV1's Justice by Any Means, or TV1's Fatal Attraction, where I profiled North Carolina child murderer Peter Moses. Or you can find me hosting Killer Kids for the Element Network, where I profiled teen killers Sarah Citroni and Jason DeLong. Or you can check out my latest article for The Crime Project, or The Crime Report, where I'm also discussing again what led me to developing and producing a true crime podcast. Last but certainly not least, many of my listeners have been messaging me on how they can donate to this podcast. On my website, MarylandsMostNotoriousMurders.com, there is a donate icon on the website where you can contribute via PayPal, via Anchor, via Ko-Fi, or the Buy Me a Coffee icons. Thank you so much for all of your constant support throughout all the years, whether if it was shown through buying or reading any of my books, or even listening to the end of this podcast. And if you don't want to contribute, you can just leave a positive review on the site. Even that'll help out. So please, please be sure to tune in next episode, where another high profile, another bizarre homicide occurring in Maryland. It will be discussed, it will be examined, and it will be profiled on Maryland's most notorious murders. And this has been A Savage Life production.